So hi, everyone. Welcome back to Let's Rethink This. I'm your host, Abby Berger. Today, I'm excited to be talking with Ayanna Dobos, who's a staff attorney at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. Ayanna has a Bachelor's of Science in Criminal Justice, Homeland Security, and Emergency Preparedness. She completed her Juris Doctorate at Emory University School of Law and now practices in St. Louis, Missouri. She is the program director and attorney for LAMI, which stands for Legal Advocacy for Adults with Mental Illness. This program helps people living with or at risk of developing mental illness address legal problems through a combination of legal and social work assistance. This approach helps clients with legal problems so that they can concentrate on their mental health and wellness. So welcome. I'm so glad to have you on today.
Thank you for having me, Abby. I'm so excited to be on today.
So I'd love to start off with you just telling us a little bit about yourself and your background. Where are you from? When and how did you get into law? And a little bit more about the work you're doing now.
Sure. So I'm actually from Washington, D.C., but I was born here in Kansas City and moved to D.C. when I was about 12 years old. I decided to go to law school after college because I knew that I wanted to have a greater impact on people in my community. And I just thought that was the best path for me at the time. Prior to the position that I'm in right now, I was a guardian ad litem for kids in the city of St. Louis with CASA of St. Louis and doing guardian ad litem work for kids in foster care. And then in this position now, I am the program director and staff attorney of the Legal Advocacy for Adults with Mental Illness Unit at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. I am a journalist practitioner, and I really do enjoy the work that I get to do for the clients.
So what's a journalist practitioner?
So a generalist practitioner is someone who practices multiple areas of the law. So I practice 7 different areas of the law, and we'll go through those a little bit later, but it's a little bit of everything, which is great for the client.
Yeah, I'm sure that's very helpful. And I'm glad to know it's called generalist, not journalist. I thought you said journalist for some reason, so good clarification. So can you tell us a little bit about the structure of legal aid or legal services of Eastern Missouri? You know, what are those areas that you help people with?
So Legal Services of Eastern Missouri has been around since 1956. We recently celebrated our 65th anniversary. We help low-income families with civil legal issues, anything from family law, public benefits, healthcare, child well-being, and domestic violence. We expanded our services to also include assistance for the immigrant population and refugee families, veterans, and community economic development, and small business and minority entrepreneurs. Legal Services now has 4 different offices, one in St. Louis City, one in St. Louis County, Hannibal, Missouri, and Union, Missouri. And we serve 21 different counties on the eastern side of Missouri.
And it's specifically for lower income people to utilize, is that right?
That's correct.
And do people pay to use it?
No. So as long as you qualify for a certain unit's eligibility requirements and then the legal services income and asset requirements, then our services are free to the client.
That is very nice because that can be very expensive. So LAMI, not LAMI, LAMI is a program of legal services, right? And that's the program that you direct, which has a pretty extensive list of services for people with mental illness. Can you share a little bit more about your program specifically?
Sure. So our specific program, again, we offer We do 7 different practice areas for our client. We realize that having one program for our clients is better than bouncing them around from unit to unit within the organization, and to keep that rapport with just one attorney, since sometimes it can be hard to build based off of their own personal experiences. So some of the practice areas that we practice are landlord-tenant or housing issues, anything related to rent and possession cases or unlawful detainer cases. In regards to public benefits, our social worker does food stamps. We are now doing assessing eligibility for SSI and SSDI. We do family law issues, so anything from simple divorces to orders of protection for survivors of domestic violence, minor guardianships, paternity, child custody, and child support cases. We do simple wills and powers of attorney, guardianship termination for people who are trying to seek unconditional release from their state guardianship. We do criminal record expungement, name changes, and municipal traffic tickets and ordinance violations.
You guys really do it all, which, I mean, all of this sounds like important things to have access to, especially, housing issues. That's a huge issue right now. Okay, so that is very helpful for people facing eviction, especially now in the pandemic. And then a couple of things I want to ask you about, just because I'm curious about them. One is the guardianship termination. So I know you said it's guardianship from the state. Will you share a little bit about why someone would have a guardianship with the state in the first place? And then what reason they would want to terminate it?
Sure. So the clients that we have come to our unit seeking what's known as an unconditional release, the way we get our clients in these types of cases is due to a past criminal case. So in that criminal case, the client was found guilty by reason of insanity. They were sentenced to a psychiatric rehabilitation center, and then they spent however many years in that psychiatric rehabilitation center. And then at some point, they petitioned for a conditional release so they could be released from the psychiatric rehabilitation center into the community with a list of conditions, which could include anything from treatment, participating in certain treatment classes, or participating in certain community groups, seeing their forensic case monitor, et cetera. It just depends on what conditions the judge believes is appropriate and the state believes is appropriate at the time. And based on the case as well. And then our job is to try to get that person under an unconditional release so they do not have those conditions and they can live their life freely. They won't have any restrictions on where they could live or have to continue to go to treatment services unless, it's their prerogative, trying to just give them back that autonomy that they should have. And so the reason why someone would want that type of freedom is, again, they have that freedom to live their life as they see fit. They've spent enough time under the state's watchful eye. And so our job is to petition the state and the court really to show that this person is capable of taking care of themselves, that they are no longer a danger to the community, and that they are productive citizens, and that they can participate and be, a productive citizen.
Do those happen often, or are they hard to challenge or get rid of?
It depends on the case. We've had a couple in my office where, the case facts were not as good, but for some other, we have a case right now where the candidate is a good candidate. For unconditional release. So it really just depends on the background of the case and how that client is doing right now.
Interesting. The other thing that you mentioned was criminal record expungement. And I know from being at Independent Center and working with our members here, that is a big deal to do an expungement on the record. So basically, in my non-legal jargon, this is my understanding of what expunging a record is. It just means that the record is sealed and it will no longer be visible to the public, especially including potential employers. Is that correct?
The answer to your question is yes. And also it depends. A lawyer's favorite two words. It depends.
Right. Of course.
So yes, the record, once the court grants the expungement, the record will be sealed and it will be no longer visible to the public. Ideally, when the conviction is expunged, then that person would not have to disclose that information to an employer. But there are exceptions to that under the statute where they would have to disclose in certain instances.
So what kinds of records can be expunged versus the ones that you would still have to tell your employer about?
Under the statute, it's fairly clear on what can be expunged and what cannot be expunged based off of the conviction. There are times that you do have to disclose to an employer. So I guess, for instance, maybe like a federal position, you would still have to disclose that to your employer. Or if you were seeking a license or some type of a permit or certificate to work in a professional field, like being a lawyer, you would have to disclose that in the application process. Working for a bank or certain law enforcement agencies, you'll still have to disclose that.
But like a normal day-to-day job, like if you're at a grocery store and you're applying for a cashier's position, or I don't know, like a Target or something, would those be covered under the expungement, do you think? Or
I would say it depends on that in particular employer. Some employers, they are required to exclude certain applicants based off of their criminal convictions due to federal or state laws or rules or regulations that they have to follow. So it really just depends on that employer and their requirements.
Interesting. So for people with a mental illness, how have you seen this expungement be beneficial to them?
I've seen it be beneficial in the sense of housing, not having certain criminal convictions on their record can help them with having that stable housing, because certain criminal convictions lead to rental discrimination for a lot of our clients, or denial of certain public benefits, voucher programs, public housing. Also in regards to employment, certain convictions can lead to workplace discrimination or even disqualification from certain jobs, and including those professional licenses and trainings. In regards to, I would say, public benefits too, clients can be denied certain unemployment benefits or food stamps, just depending on what the conviction is. Voting rights is a big one. Having those convictions expunged will restore that client back as if they didn't commit, that did not receive that conviction. So they'll be able to participate in the voting process, which is so essential, especially in the United States. I think it also, we've seen it give clients the benefit of having driver's license privileges reinstated, which is really big for our clients. Having steady employment and even just having those relationships in the community, being able to interact with others freely. And then like education, also being able to obtain student loans.
Yeah, that's all really important things that you wouldn't necessarily think about if you've never had a criminal charge on your record that is preventing you from doing all those things that you just listed. Well, I think these are all really great services that you provide. And the one thing that's really cool about legal services is that you're an attorney and you work with a social worker on a lot of these issues, which I think is very helpful because an attorney's job is really the law, and then the social worker is more of that support and that, I guess, ongoing relationship with your clients. So can you tell us a little bit more about how that partnership works within legal services?
Sure. So the great thing about legal services is that we have this holistic advocacy approach, and we work as an interdisciplinary team. And with that approach, it really recognizes or helps us to recognize like a reciprocal impact of the legal case that the client currently has, and also those social work services that they are also in need of. It's not usually just one thing that they're coming in the door for. It's usually multiple different things that either I take on as the attorney or our social worker and Mel will take on as a social worker. And, you know, we see that some of the things that our social worker does in order to kind of bridge that gap between a legal case and some of the social work issues that the client might be having, we offer assistance with food stamps or to assistance with getting medical health insurance benefits. We do LIHEAP applications, so low-income home energy assistance program, applications for clients, rental assistance programs, which is really big right now due to the pandemic, and making sure that there's funding if they are behind in back rent, and safe at home applications for our clients who are either currently or have experienced domestic violence and they feel as though they need that extra blanket of safety in order to protect themselves.
And you guys also work with community partners. Like, I know legal services is involved with Independent Center, and you guys are available to the members here. So how does the partnership work with outside community partners?
So we do a lot of community outreach with many community partners. And so some of that sometimes is to provide legal clinics like we do at the Independent Center, bringing that legal support and services to our community partners. Other times it's educational presentations on different practice areas of the law that are should be on our community partners' radar, especially in regards to COVID. There have been a lot of requests for housing presentations and how to get certain benefits like unemployment benefits and public food stamp benefit, other public benefits. And then it's really just also like sharing community partners resources with our clients. And really just making sure that we have a reciprocal relationship with each other.
Yeah, I think for Independent Center members, it's really beneficial because we also help with benefits, but sometimes you need a legal eye to look at it, or you just need somebody with a little bit more expertise in the area. I know a lot of our members have actually done wills and powers of attorney through legal services, which is so great because if you don't have one of those, that's not the best situation to be in, especially in regards to end of life support. So that's been very helpful to a lot of our members. I want to kind of pivot the conversation to talk a little bit about legal services on a national level, right? So this organization is very big. And where are legal services available? I know I was living in North Carolina, and one of my friends worked for Legal Services of North Carolina doing something totally different, really related to farm work and immigrant rights. And so it's a little bit different. So can you tell us about the national organization and what that looks like in every city? Is it varied based on what the population is needing?
So I would say that most major cities and every state has some sort of version of legal aid or legal services. Sometimes there are multiple legal aids within one state. And so it just depends on their funding, what they're able to receive in federal funds or state funds. And I believe that's what determines what they are and aren't able to do for the clients in their communities. And the same would be for us. You know, depending on the funding that we get kind of determines what we are and aren't able to do. But fortunately, we are able to do a lot here, specifically at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. We have many units that do different areas of the law. So it really, really helps clients to be able to have almost a one-stop shop for all their legal, civil legal needs at the very least. And I think that the LAMI program is unique in the sense that it's specifically for adults who have mental illness or are at risk for developing a mental illness. I'm going to make the assumption that not all legal aids in the country have that specific programming like we do here. And I think the community is really appreciative that we have the funding for the specific type of work that we need to do.
Yeah, it's interesting because Missouri is well known for having good mental health supports. It's not great. You know, if you look at our national statistics, there are still so many people who do not receive services, even in Missouri, when people constantly preach about how great our services are. So I think it speaks to the need that we're one of the best and still we're not serving all of the people that need support. So that's pretty cool that Legal Services of Eastern Missouri has that specific programming. If somebody listening lives outside of Missouri and wants help with any of these issues, would you recommend that they just reach out to their local legal services?
Yes. So we've had actually potential clients call or email us and say that they live in a different state. And unfortunately, we're not able to help them, but we usually are able to just look up through Google which legal aid is in their community and connect them with that resource.
And then I know you said that it's free to utilize if you're of a certain income level. And I guess, like, who can utilize it? Do you have to have a serious mental illness diagnosis? Could it be like a not so serious, you know, like what's the cutoff on who can use those services?
Sure. So for our program specifically, you do have to reside in the city of St. Louis. And reside doesn't necessarily mean that you have a formal address in the city. It could mean that you're living in a homeless shelter or you're living with somebody in the city, like a family member or friend, and you're just residing there, you know, for the time being when you need our services. And we're usually able to help, you know, those clients as well, as long as you reside in the city. As far as the mental illness piece, there is no severity level that would at least like disqualify you for our services, or even a minimal level. You could either have a formal diagnosis or be at risk for developing one. And so, you know, that's really just like we have a pretty good understanding of what it means to be at risk. And honestly, that could be anybody. So, you know, it really just kind of opens the door to allow us to have some flexibility in allowing clients into the program. And then once you get past those eligibility requirements for our program, then it's those eligibility requirements that I mentioned earlier for legal services, income, and asset guidelines that we have to follow.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, because I just want to ask you about it. When you said you guys do like educational presentations, so who does those and where do you host them?
So right now, usually with community partners, we'll set up some type of panel with us, or depend, they can just let us know what topics are of interest for their members of their organization, for their staff, for, you know, their particular clients. And they can just shoot Ann or I an email or give us a call and say that this is a particular area of interest. And then we'll schedule, put something on the calendar so that we are able to give that an accurate presentation of whatever those legal or social work issues are.
Are you seeing an uptick in the need for big presentations? I know you said people are wondering about rental assistance and those like food stamps and things like that, but are you seeing an uptick in people wanting to know about a particular area now that we're in a pandemic and kind of coming out of it a little bit?
Yes, we have a slight uptick for educational programs specifically pertaining to landlord-tenant issues and mostly pertain to tenants' rights and back rental issues. However, we've seen an increase in referrals for those landlord-tenant issues, particularly either they can be pre-litigation issues where we can try to negotiate something out with the landlord and possibly get funding for that client, or if there's already been a lawsuit filed, coming in on those cases and trying to negotiate something if it's appropriate.
All these services are so essential, and I'm glad that you guys are providing them to the community. I think it's very needed and very helpful to have somebody who knows the ins and outs of the law assisting you in legal matters, because they're often very complex and hard to navigate. Is there anything else you want to mention specifically about your program and the work that you guys are doing in the community?
So we have another unit within Legal Services called Youth and Family Advocacy Program, and they help youth who are under the age of 18, and typically they're homeless youth. And so we're trying to dovetail our programs and create a coordinated community outreach for the both of the programs to allow for a continuum of services, just in case the Youth and Family Advocacy Program, that particular client either ages out of the program or they aren't eligible for whatever other reason. And so we have extended our reach primarily due to my experience as a guardian ad litem and seeing kids aging out in foster care, that they usually have some type of legal issue going on or need assistance, further assistance with getting public benefits set up. And so we've expanded that outreach to the St. Louis City Juvenile Court, to CASA of St. Louis, and to the St. Louis City Children's Division. So they know about our program and the services that we offer, so we can help those kids transitioning out of care.
That's really cool. I did not know that you had done that. You see so many people, and we even see it in behavioral health. You know, you have those programs for youth services and you have adult services, but there's not typically a good bridge in between the two, and you can try, but usually it's different organizations and different systems that you have to get involved in, and it's tough. So I think that's very cool. And, I hope a lot of people utilize that and are able to bridge more easily without, you know, a ton of disruption in their services and what they're able to accomplish. So that's very cool. Well, my last question, I've asked everybody that I've interviewed this question, so I'll ask you. And I'm curious to see what your answer is. But the question is, if you could debunk one myth about mental illness, what would it be?
I think the biggest myth that I would debunk is that people with mental illness are violent or they're incapable of taking care of themselves. You know, just based off the clients that we've seen and that we deal with every single day, you know, like it's not that they're not able to take care of themselves. They're actually perfectly capable. It's just that a lot of times, you know, we see organizations or institutions put labels on them saying that they can and cannot do certain things when they are capable of doing certain things. They just need that support and that encouragement and those supports in the community to make it possible for them. And I guess on the violence piece, you know, like we've had clients that come in and, you know, landlords or whomever it is say, you know, this person is violent. I don't want to rent to them. I don't want them to be employed with me. But it's not, there's usually an issue that's deeper than that. And in the cases that I've seen, it's been that the client just hasn't sought treatment yet or isn't ready to seek treatment. And then they'll come to our program and they'll just be at that point where they're ready to get engaged with those type of services. And, you know, once they're engaged with those services, it's really a 180 turnaround. People grow, people change. And just because you have a mental illness doesn't mean that you will not grow and change and be a productive member of society.
Very true. And with that, I feel like that's a good way to end the interview. And, you know, thank you so much for sharing more about your services and legal advocacy for adults with mental illness and everything that you kind of explained and walked us through today. So I want to make sure everybody listening knows that I am going to put the links in the show notes for how to get connected with the Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. You can email them. Their email is laami@lsem.org. You can also follow us on Instagram. Our handle is @letsrethinkthispod. For more information, we'll be posting about all of our episodes and you can find the links to the show notes there or wherever you're listening now. We also launched a Loyal Listeners Club. So if you like what you hear each week and want to donate to support the podcast, you can become either a part-time or a full-time listener. That's just the title. And donate either $5 or $10 to us monthly. These, of course, will be free ongoing. It just helps to support this content creation, helps us to, you know, talk to more people and bring you new episodes each week. So if you want to do that, go to our website and sign up. If you are struggling with a mental illness or a substance use disorder, please visit our website. It's www.independentcenter.org for a list of local and national resources that you can utilize and reach out to for support. I can't wait to talk to you guys next week.